It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Free speech has become an interesting issue on college campuses for the grandchildren of the people who have fond memories of 1960s-era protests. In 2017, protesters disrupted a speech by right-wing activist Robert Spencer, who propagates a deeper connection between Islam and terrorism than facts allow. Spencer accused the protesters of abridging his free speech rights. Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos never got a chance to yell at the people who were protesting them. Berkeley canceled appearances by both of them, citing safety concerns. Our next guest has some issues with that, not on an ideological ground, but on the grounds that when universities start to police speech, they are heading down a very dangerous path. What do you think about speech on campus? Should we limit speech by people whom the majority thinks has dangerous views? Is that in and of itself dangerous? 800-642-1234 is the number to call as usual. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Keith E. Whittington is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Politics in the Department of Politics at Princeton University. His new book is Speak Freely, Why Universities Must Defend Free Speech. Keith, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the history of speech on college campuses. Who gets it? And most importantly, who historically has not gotten it?
Sure. So speech on college campuses is relatively recent. If you looked at universities in the 19th century, they would have been, in general, much more restrictive of free speech. And over the course of the 20th century, there was sort of a long process of opening campuses up and making them more vibrant intellectual places, more speech available for faculty and for students both. That came in sort of fits and starts, some at the very early beginnings of the 20th century. There were big battles over communists on campus in the 1940s and 1950s. There's obviously the kinds of battles over anti-war protests and the like in the 1960s. So it's been a gradual tendency to make speech more open, but it's been a long struggle.
So what has the struggle, where's the struggle come from? And again, who has speech and who generally doesn't have speech in our society?
Yeah, so the struggle's been across a couple of different dimensions. There is, on one hand, a fight about how much speech faculty should have on campus, and so can they be punished by campus administrators or by government officials for things that they write or things that they say, whether in the classroom or in the public sphere. And then there's been sort of a separate battle about how much of a free speech right do students have on college campuses, and can they likewise speak freely in protesting on college campuses and the like. And ultimately, by the 1960s, rights for both of those groups had been expanded quite dramatically. Often the pressure for expanding that came from the political left. It was conservatives who wanted to shut down speech on campus and make it much more restrictive for both faculty and for students. And it was faculty and students who tend to be on the left of the political spectrum who were pushing harder to open up the range of free speech on college campuses.
And now that's switched around, hasn't it?
It has tended to switch around lately, I think, both in the sense that conservatives are now much more supportive of free speech than they historically were. If you were to look at conservatives, both on campuses and off campus, in the 1950s or 1960s, they would have been much more restrictive of free speech. I think conservatives now tend to be much more protective of free speech. And likewise, the political left has become more uncertain about how much they ought to be protecting free speech on campus, but also in society more generally.
So we're going to get to that in a second. We are talking to Keith Whittington of Princeton about free speech. He wrote a book called Speak Freely, Why Universities Must Defend Free Speech. We are taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've got a couple of calls in already, Keith. Bill from De Pere, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I feel very strongly that campuses should not restrict speech from either the right or the left. But I think it's also important that they remember that the bulk of the Americans are somewhere in the middle, so that when they book these speakers, you know, the majority of the speakers should be from the center of the political spectrum, and then occasionally bring in people from both the right side and the left side.
Okay, thank you for that, Bill. Keith, I have a question about that. I mean, isn't that kind of restricting speech in and of itself? Groups, there are different groups on campus. It's not like, you know, UW-Madison brings people in. It's the young Republicans or the young Democrats or whatever that bring people in to speak. Don't they have a right to bring whoever they want in, no matter how hateful or how crazy their ideas may be?
Yeah. So it is true that for most universities, the university itself will bring in speakers, but also they open the door to lots of groups on campuses to bring in speakers, whether those are groups that are primarily consist of faculty. So in my case, the Department of Politics, for example, might bring speakers to Princeton University, but also lots of student groups bringing speakers to campus. And the virtue of that is it does allow for a lot of different kinds of speakers. Those different groups and constituencies on campus will have different interests. And so some students on the political right will want to bring in primarily conservative speakers, but likewise, groups on the left will want to bring in primarily speakers from the left, and that makes campus as a whole much more interesting. And so I think that what we really want to try to create on campus is that kind of openness, allowing lots of different constituencies to have opportunities to bring onto campus people that they find interesting, and the university probably shouldn't be trying to micromanage that.
Okay, so why is speech on campus so important? And does this calculus change when we're talking about private universities rather than public universities?
Well, the calculus does change a little bit when we're talking about private universities instead of public universities in two ways. So one is constitutional law treats private universities a little differently than public universities. So public universities have to worry about what the First Amendment restrictions are on their ability to control speech, because the public universities are an extension of state governments. Private universities have more of a free hand in that regard. Private universities can be also somewhat different because some of them have a slightly different mission. So religious institutions, for example, might think that the scope of academic inquiry and free speech on campus ought to be at least somewhat restricted because they take certain issues as a matter of faith that are not going to be challenged or contested on that particular campus. And so they might restrict the range of discussions that might occur on college campuses. As a practical matter, most private universities don't try to do that very much, but some do, and so there are some potential differences between the two.
So I actually asked this question a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the Marquette decision. If a professor at Wheaton College or Roberts University were to say, hey, my views on abortion or LGBT rights have evolved, and I'm going to write a blog about that, saying that we, you know, I recognize pro-choice, those colleges don't recognize pro-choice. Could they fire that person for their free speech?
It depends a lot on the very specific details of those particular institutions and particular contracts that they've entered into with faculty there. It is true, I think, that some more explicitly religious universities are going to be more restrictive. And whether that would extend so far as to faculty's blog post on abortion, for example, at a religiously conservative school, might be true, but I wouldn't actually generalize that. I think in many cases it would not be true. So, for example, I began my career teaching at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., which is a Catholic university, obviously, and I was teaching in the political science department. And one thing that they took great pains to emphasize to me when they hired me was that neither the university nor the church would be looking over my shoulders to what I was teaching in the classroom, for example. And so in my case, given some of what I teach, I would wind up talking about issues like abortion. And they were emphatic that the university gave me complete freedom in how I approached those issues with students and talked about them on campuses. That wouldn't be equally true at all religious institutions, but an awful lot of them would adopt that kind of approach.
Are you familiar with the Marquette case involving Professor John McAdams?
I am.
Okay, so that was something that kind of was along these lines, where Marquette said, we have rules, we are a Jesuit institution, and we have rules about how people should be treated. He violated those rules. They argued that he harassed a fellow teacher, a grad student who was a teacher. And he argued very clearly that his free speech rights had been abrogated. So how do you see this one?
Yeah, so I think Marquette's in a somewhat complicated place because they wanted to simultaneously emphasize academic freedom in their agreements with faculty. So the employment contracts they had reached with faculty embraced the same kind of expansive protections for academic freedom that most public and private universities have adopted and that the American Association of University Professors has advocated. At the same time, though, Marquette has emphasized elsewhere that they have particular values that are associated with the school and its particular religious traditions. And at least in this context, they thought that those came to some conflict. I think we'd also be in a different situation if the courts had agreed with the university that the faculty member was actually guilty of harassing a graduate student. And certainly that's part of Marquette's claim that he harassed her. And if the courts had agreed with that, the professor would be in a much more difficult situation because even if you have broad protections for freedom of speech for faculty, that would not necessarily protect them if there was a finding of harassment. In this case, the court was just very skeptical of the university's conclusions about that and as a consequence thought that the university was using that as an excuse to try to punish a professor because they really just didn't like what he was saying.
That's an excellent point. Thank you for pointing that out. We're talking about free speech on college campuses with my guest today. He says it's essential that the college campuses are a bastion of free speech. We're going to talk more about who gets speech in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Head to a college campus and you will hear a lot of people talking about and perhaps protesting speech. Our guest today says that free speech is essential for colleges and universities to do their jobs as part of a democracy. And when we stop people from speaking, no matter how horrible their views, we can hurt ourselves in the long run. Give us a call and let us know what you think about free speech on campuses, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Are you a professor or an undergrad or grad student? Academics, we want to hear from you on free speech on campuses. We want to hear your thoughts maybe on protests, on trigger warnings, maybe building name changes, all of it. How does the way we mandate speech on campus relate to the rest of your society? How does it affect you in terms of how you go about your daily life? 800-642-1234. So Keith Whittington of Princeton, give me some examples of good free speech on campus.
Yeah, so I think the example I gave earlier of how I began at Catholic University of America teaching political science of a university that took real efforts to emphasize to me that as an instructor, they expected me to have complete freedom to approach the subjects I was teaching as in the best ways I thought I ought to, given my own professional judgment, even if that was in some conflict with the views of other faculty members or campus officials, or in that case of the Catholic Church, I should be protected in doing that. And you want university leaders to be clear about that in general. So my own current university president, Chris Eisgruber at Princeton University, has started becoming very vocal in public about his support for free speech on college campuses, both for university faculty and also for students, and the importance of having diverse voices on campus, being able to speak out on the issues that they think are important. So university leadership, I think, is important to send the right signals on these issues. It's also, you know, administrative policies that have to be tailored to try to be supportive of speech. So how much protection do you give for faculty for their employment? Who do you allow to invite speakers to campus? Where on campus can you have protests, for example? And those are going to vary a little bit campus to campus, but they're all important as for creating the infrastructure for free speech on college campuses.
So you open your book with the story of Carrie Nation at UC Berkeley. First of all, tell us the story and start out with who Carrie Nation was.
Sure. So Carrie Nation was a prohibitionist in the early 20th century, a fairly radical voice in support of restrictions on the sale and consumption of alcohol in America. And she was also a frequent speaker on college campuses around the turn of the century. As you might expect, somebody going onto college campuses urging the prohibition on the consumption of alcohol wasn't necessarily a popular position on college campuses then, as it wouldn't be now. And she was greeted with protests, which sometimes got quite raucous, sometimes even violent. And often the result of that was she would be arrested because other people were protesting her. That was seen in the legal context of 1900 or so. That was seen as disturbing the peace. And she was the one that responsible for disturbing the peace by saying things that other people found very disturbing that would lead them to protest her. The law has changed dramatically since then, such that now we expect that speakers ought to be protected in their speech, even when the audience finds their ideas disturbing, even if the audience protests and gets loud in reaction to that. And the expectation is that the burden is on the audience not to get violent and not to disturb the peace, rather than the burden being on the speaker not to rile up the audience.
And I see this, you know, the shutting down Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos. I understand why people wanted to shut them down, but isn't it better just to let them speak and yell at them, or you know, let them get up on stage, and then you have a clash of free speech?
I think that's right. I think universities in particular ought to be places where people can get up on a stage and deliver a talk that students and others on campus are going to find provocative and controversial and disagreeable. I think those of us who are inviting people to campus have some responsibility to try to invite people to campus that we think are going to be interesting and useful and helpful. We don't simply want to be inviting people to campus that are provocative for the sake of being provocative, but aren't actually going to lead anyone to be thinking more carefully about the topic at hand. Universities ought to be places where we can think about things carefully. But they ought to be places where you can be able to discuss a wide range of ideas in a serious way, and not just cut off a whole set of ideas and say, well, those are too controversial here. And as a consequence, you can talk about them on cable TV shows, you can talk about them in the public library, but you can't talk about them on a university campus.
We are talking about free speech on college campuses, and we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've got Crash from Milwaukee who's calling in. Crash, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Okay, what's your question?
Well, I have more of a comment, which may lead to a question, which is there a place in our society to kind of draw hard lines about things that, like, yeah, you can talk about them, but as institutions, you shouldn't be allowed a forum to talk about? For instance, when people like Richard Spencer or even Ann Coulter talk about how some people don't deserve certain rights. Isn't that a hard line that as a society we can kind of draw?
Crash, thank you for that. Keith, I've always had this axiom that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater because that is dangerous speech and people can get killed. I think that Crash is sort of getting towards that a little bit. Is some speech just too dangerous and it needs to be stopped?
Well, the Supreme Court has tried to be very restrictive on what we might characterize as dangerous speech, in part because the history of American constitutional law is such that governments declare lots of things to be dangerous, and as a consequence, you ought to arrest people for saying them. And so at the same time that Carrie Nation was going around the country advocating for alcohol prohibition and was being arrested for doing so, likewise, anarchists and socialists were being routinely arrested for advocating their ideas. And American constitutional law went through a bit of a sea change in the mid-20th century to say, you know, it's not such a good idea in democracy to arrest people for advocating controversial political ideas just because we think they might lead to dangerous consequences. And we really don't want to empower government officials to be making those decisions as to which ideas they find particularly dangerous and disturbing. We'd be much better off if we protected free speech generally, even if the result is that some people will say things that we think are very misguided and maybe even point in dangerous directions.
Isn't that the point of counter-protesting? That if you don't like the speech of the person that has been brought in by whomever, faculty or some sort of student group, that you can counter-protest outside of the building, inside of the building perhaps?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there are some restrictions, I think, on how much protesting ought to be going on inside the building at the same time somebody's trying to give a speech. But I think it's right in general that the best response to speech that we find disagreeable and disturbing is to engage them at the level of ideas and explain to people why those ideas are dangerous and disturbing and they shouldn't be accepted. I think it's also true that there are some speakers and some ideas that the best course of action is simply to ignore them because they are pretty marginal fringe ideas and not many people are paying attention, and you don't necessarily need to give them more attention by spending lots of time protesting. So Richard Spencer, who was mentioned a while ago, a figure on the far right, was going around to the college campuses giving speeches. Mostly he was not being invited. Instead, he was renting out auditoriums that were available for public rental in order to speak on college campuses. And eventually he stopped. And he stopped in part because there were counter protests, but he stopped in part also because no one was showing up to actually listen to his speeches. And if you don't show up, people will stop trying to go around giving those kind of speeches.
Capitalism actually does play a role in this. Supply and demand.
They're looking for an audience.
Right.
That's exactly right. And if you don't give them the audience, then what's the point from their perspective?
We are talking about free speech on college campus. Randy from Madison, welcome to the program.
Good morning. By the way, last week I was arrested for shouting theater at a crowded fire.
Thank you, Randy.
Which leads into the fact that I've noticed that so many comedians, starting with Jerry Seinfeld, are saying they just simply don't want to play campuses anymore. Mm. You know, too much. I call them sensitivity Gestapo. I'm risking sounding much more right, much more to the right than I actually am. But I think perhaps the big problem is that so many kids arrive at campus never having been challenged to hear things they don't want to hear, either in school or by there's a process sociologists call sorting, where you only hang out with people that you agree with. So any other opinions seem like mental illness. So I just wanted to float that as a possibility.
Thank you very much, Randy. So, yes, comedians have many have stopped coming to college campuses because they get accused of abrogating people's rights or trigger warnings. This is a thing. Keith?
It is a thing. It's interesting because college campuses at one point would have been the places where you would expect edgy comedians to go because students were more open to that than what you might find on The Tonight Show, for example. But I think that's right. A lot of comedians have decided that college campuses might not be the best place for edgy comedy, that they will get protested and it's not worth the effort. And comedy is often hard because it is often subconsciously working on the borders of what's acceptable. And sometimes, of course, comedians fall over the edge of that. So comedians are often controversial, and sometimes they are right there on the bleeding edge of our free speech battles because they are skirting the limits of what we think is acceptable for people to be saying in public.
I want to change the subject just a little bit. The Roberts Court, the Supreme Court under John Roberts, has ruled that money talks. We were talking about, you know, the fact that that Richard Spencer didn't get an audience, and so we had to stop, right? But the Roberts Court has ruled that corporations are people, that money constitutes speech. The arguments against the Citizens United ruling are that it allows money to quash speech of voting Americans. Do you see a slippery slope here, and how does that relate to speech on campus?
So it relates in a couple of ways, I think. I mean, part of the concern about money, and maybe specifically corporations, but thinking about money in general and in the speech context, is that it can overwhelm the amount of speech on campus and in the public sphere more generally, because there are so many resources they can just swamp all of their voices. Mm. And this has been a persistent struggle in trying to think about how do you make sure that there's space for people who don't necessarily have lots of resources to nonetheless get their message out. And so part of the reason why the court over the course of the 20th century became very interested in opening up spaces for free speech was precisely because actors in society who did not necessarily have lots of resources needed to be able to make use of things like public parks and street corners and sidewalks in order to get their message out, because they couldn't control the New York Times, for example, or CBS News. And so it is a genuine struggle to make sure that people without lots of resources can nonetheless get their message across. I think we ought to be a little concerned if the way we want to approach that is to say, well, let's empower some government officials to decide that some people have too big of a megaphone and therefore we need to cut them down to size.
We're talking about free speech on college campuses, and we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Anne from Monona, welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, there's an effort by the far right to get more far right-wing speakers on U.S. campuses. And I, in my opinion, the First Amendment was added to the Constitution to prevent the new government in the 1780s, from suppressing dissent against the government, not to allow college students to shout obscenities at one another. Government criticism or the suppression of it is dangerous, and I don't think, like the recent McAdams case, had really anything to do with free speech, which is a term just thrown around, you know, at random. I think the administration should have talked to the TA first and said, you know, that's kind of doctrinaire to say that students can't discuss abortion because it's already been decided. And I think they then should have talked, when he started harassing the student, to Professor McAdams and said, you can't be this vicious, you know, to a PA, because you can drive people like this off campus and it will hurt the university too.
That's it. You bring up a lot of topics. One of the things you bring up is that people actually have cordial conversations about this stuff these days, which I'm not necessarily sure is true. But the other thing that I've heard a lot of, Keith Whittington, is First Amendment rights are about government speech. It's not about my speech and your speech to each other.
Right. I mean, we might think that the core concern of the First Amendment is to make sure that people can criticize the government. At the very least, we want people to be able to do that in a democracy, because otherwise we can't hold government accountable. But we also want speech for lots of other things. And we've interpreted the First Amendment more broadly than just political speech, precisely because we think other kinds of speech is valuable, potentially. So we can think about that in the context of art, for example, and protecting literature and film as being important sources of artistic expression that we think ought to be constitutionally protected as well. Or in the university context, where our core commitment is to try to pursue the truth as best we can. And as a consequence, we want to recognize people's freedom to be able to ask difficult questions, pursue the answers wherever they think they might lead. And that might be on topics that are directly relevant to government, but they may be on lots of other topics. Scientists thinking about climate change, for example. Mm. And we want freedom to be able to protect those things as well. So the First Amendment has applications in lots of different contexts. I should note one other thing that the caller mentioned, which is, sometimes we use the freedom of speech to talk to one another in fairly unpleasant ways. Mm-hmm. And we might think that that's not the core of what the First Amendment is designed to protect either. And there's certainly some truth in that. We might prefer that that's not how people talk to one another. It's not the primary reason why we have the First Amendment. It's for people to shout obscenities at one another. But on the other hand, we ought to be very nervous about empowering government officials or campus officials to be able to intervene and say, sorry, but you're not being nice enough in how right. you're advocating for your position. Because people often aren't very nice when they're advocating their positions, and they care passionately about a given subject. And we need to give people some freedom to be able to speak their mind in the way that makes the most sense to them and expresses their ideas as clearly as possible from their perspective. And sometimes that means they're going to behave in rude and unpleasant ways.
What that brings up for me is the difference between speaking and listening. And I think what Anne is saying is that maybe we need to listen to each other more. Thank you for that, Anne. We are talking about free speech on college campuses with our guest today. We're going to talk a little bit about the limits of speech and dig into this trigger warning stuff in a moment. It's the Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are talking about free speech on campus with our guest, Keith Whittington. We are also taking your calls, 800-642-1234. How do you navigate the line between free speech and respecting the needs of students who have perhaps experienced trauma or bullying? Again, that number is 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. So Keith Whittington from Princeton, I want to talk about this issue of trigger warnings. I mean, this is partly what's keeping college people from comedians from performing on college campuses. I'm interested. The whole Hannah Gadsby thing has been going around Netflix. It's a big thing, and I've wondered occasionally if. If she came to a college campus in the U.S., would she be allowed to do her show, or would people see trigger warnings in that? What are these trigger warnings? What are people talking about here?
Yeah, so the basic concept of trigger warnings is the idea that students ought to be warned about when there's going to be material presented in class that might be particularly disturbing. The
starting point for the idea is really thinking about people who have suffered serious traumas in the past and as a consequence might be psychologically harmed by things that remind them of those traumas. But in practice, it's been expanded way beyond that to really try to slap warning labels on anything that might be controversial in a classroom or on a college campus. And I think the concern about sort of using those willy-nilly is that they, one, can be used as a way of trying to exclude controversial materials from college syllabi and from the classroom. So it just becomes easier to water down your syllabus rather than include things that people are going to insist ought to get warning labels on them.
So this is self-censorship you're talking about. Okay.
No, it's self-censorship by faculty.
Right.
It can be self-censorship by students. So students, for example, might shy away from material if you put a trigger warning in front of it. And so the students will think, well, maybe I can't handle that. And so I shouldn't actually read that work or I shouldn't talk about that subject. And they will wind up doing less than they otherwise could do. So a lot of the concern around trigger warnings is around that concern of it having a chilling effect on what kinds of conversations can take place, what kinds of discussions can occur because you've overwarned about how sensitive and difficult the material might actually be.
So do you have examples of instances when trigger warnings have actually threatened free speech and intellectual freedom?
So I think as a practical matter, I think mostly there's been a lot of resistance on university campuses to adopting sort of mandatory trigger warnings, and so faculty have mostly pushed back against that and have been relatively successful in the United States. But there have been some cases where universities have required faculty to adopt trigger warnings, and the result has been that some material winds up getting left on the cutting room floor rather than using them in classes. And for example, in the law school context, there's been real concern about can you teach cases involving sexual violence in criminal law classes? Because maybe some of the students have been traumatized by sexual violence in the past. They might find those cases and materials particularly disturbing. And as a consequence, maybe that means that that material shouldn't be covered in class. Or if it is covered in class, maybe some students should be allowed not to have to read it or deal with it or take tests on it. And then you really worry, well, are you then training a bunch of lawyers that don't understand the law around sexual violence because we were too worried about traumatizing them by having conversations about it? And obviously, I think that raises real problems then in an educational context and what you're trying to accomplish in a classroom.
Sometimes the hard conversations are necessary. Yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as faculty member, you have to be sensitive about where students are, right? I mean, so I think the goal, of course, is to try to get them to engage and to think about hard topics. And, we all make mistakes in the classroom as we're trying to do that. You're trying to figure out where the students, where do they find discomfort? How can they best approach difficult topics in a way that's productive and helpful for them to be thinking about those topics?
Right.
And, you know, sometimes you lose students because you approach it in a way that doesn't land right with them and they shut down or they start worrying about the conversations that's going on. So you have to be sensitive to where the students are, what kinds of things they can talk about and how they can talk about them. But that shouldn't mean that you're then trying to avoid hard topics. It's a question about how you best approach it such that students can productively engage with it.
We are talking about free speech on campus. We got a lot of calls coming in. Joshua from Madison, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, my comment would be that, you know, if I'm paying tuition costs, which I think UW now is around $17,000 a year, $20,000 a year, mm-hmm. If I don't want my dollars being paid to a speaker that I don't agree with, I have at least the right to tell him that. You know what I mean? Like there's, as far as, and especially if all these speakers try to be sensational. They have messages that are racist and xenophobic, and it's just.
I get you, Joshua. So he's paying money to go to this school. and this school or some professors at this school decide to bring in somebody like Milo Yiannopoulos. And Joshua says, I have the right to protest against that.
Certainly have the right to protest against it. I think where I would caution against protest is you don't want to push that so far to say, therefore, that speaker ought to be disinvited and shouldn't be allowed to speak on campus. Perfectly reasonable to say, I disagree with that speaker, and let me tell you why I disagree with that speaker. And I think it's one of the things that's really important to emphasize about universities that I think students coming in don't always appreciate, parents who are paying the bills don't always appreciate, is it is true that universities are expensive, tuition costs are high. But the reason why you go to universities precisely is in order to encounter ideas and be able to talk about them seriously. And that will include talking about ideas that you find disagreeable. And so I guarantee you, no matter what your particular views are, you will find people on the college campus who disagree with you and disagree with you strongly. Mm-hmm. And you will encounter those disagreements in the classroom and outside the classroom. And that's what makes college exciting. And so people should understand what they're signing up for when they show up at a college campus. They're signing up for encountering ideas that are hard and encountering ideas that they find disagreeable. And they ought to embrace that. When they're on a college campus, rather than try to shy away from it and say, well, if I'm paying all this money, I shouldn't be confronted with things I find disagreeable. That's not what universities are all about.
Confront back, or find a creative way to confront back rather than standing outside and yelling. There are ways that you can use your speech to confront the people that you disagree with, right?
For sure. I mean, so certainly when I was a student, I was looking for ways to find people who had ideas that were very different than my own, precisely because I often learned a lot from those people. They didn't necessarily persuade me that they were right at the end of the day, but I understood their ideas much better as a consequence of those conversations, and I understood my own positions much better.
Okay, but do you agree, though, that when you were in college, it was a different atmosphere?
It was a somewhat different atmosphere, although I think there were lots of similarities as well. I mean, these are somewhat persistent struggles. And so some of the details change as to what exactly students find offensive, how exactly they express that. But it's always true that people disagree, and when people encounter things they find disagreeable, they tend to object to them and often think that people should stop saying those things that they find disagreeable. And students were doing that when I was an undergraduate in the late 1980s, just like they're doing it now.
Okay, so I think
some of the details change.
So I think that Joshua and some people who protested against, like Ann Coulter or Richard Spencer, their argument, as I've heard it before, is these are people who are propagating things that are un-American, that they do not follow American values, xenophobia, racism, white supremacy. And so those issues are more important, more at the forefront than they were when you and I were in college and we were disagreeing about, you know, how to best serve the poor.
Sure. No, I think some of those ideas are on the extremes of our political debates, but they are part of our political debates. Students ought to hear what those debates are and make up their own minds about what positions they want to take on those issues. And we ought to be very nervous about empowering anybody, whether it's government officials like, say, President Donald Trump, or university presidents, to be able to make decisions about, well, which ideas do you find to be un-American and therefore shouldn't be expressed in public. And undoubtedly, Donald Trump would have different ideas about that than many of the students who are protesting Ann Coulter. But if you start empowering government officials to be making those decisions, they're going to make decisions that we often are going to think are too restrictive and deeply problematic. And they have in the past, right? And so when university officials could say, well, look, we don't want to bring people to campus who are un-American, Earlier in our history, including quite late in the 20th century, that meant we don't want to bring socialists to campus, we don't want to bring anarchists to campus, we don't want to bring gay rights speakers to campus, we don't want to bring atheists to campus. After 9/11, there would have been arguments that you shouldn't bring Muslim speakers to campus, all on the same basic platform of saying, well, look, those speakers are un-American. They're promoting ideas that we find very disturbing, and if people believe them, would lead to very bad results. And instead, college ought to be a place where, okay, well, let's hear those ideas and let's work them through. And if we think they're wrong and disagreeable, then let's explain and understand why.
Or just don't show up. Right.
Sure.
We've got a few minutes left, and we've got some phone calls. Jacob from Mosini, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me. I wanted to ask your guest, Keith Whittington, if he's heard of Professor Kevin Barrett from Madison, Wisconsin. I believe he was he criticized Israel or something, and he was fired or something happened with him. Because, I mean, there's also a lot of things with people on the left not being able to get their voice out. Like a prime example would be Gore Vidal once said he couldn't get the master list of nations we invaded since World War II in progressive magazines. And I know, like, John Cusack and Arundhati Roy has that book, Things You Can and Cannot Say, and they talk about how, you know, the media can tell us about ISIS cutting off heads, but if we say how COPASAS, the people that we trained for, like, 30 years did the same things and things worse, and then Chile and all over the world, KUBARC, School of Americas, you know, all kinds of things, Craig Murray.
Okay, Jacob, I'm going to stop you here, partly because your line is really crackly and I'm not hearing everything you're saying, but I think we're getting the gist of it. So I appreciate that. Keith, you want to answer that?
Yeah, that's a really important point to emphasize that not just right-wing speakers who get shouted down on college campuses or right-wing ideas who get excluded. Often it is people on the political left who find themselves being suppressed. And that's true on college campuses as well as off college campuses. So people on the left often get a better reception on college campuses than they might in American society more generally. But even on college campuses, people on the left sometimes run into real trouble. Sometimes from people, other people on the left who think they've taken the wrong set of positions in the left. And as a consequence, ought to be disinvited or shouted down. But on occasion as well, that they run afoul of conservative activists who think that those speakers and ideas are troubling. And sometimes conservative activists who are off campus but intervening in campus debates in order to try to shut down speakers. So everybody's potentially at risk when we open the door to censorship and efforts to shut down controversial ideas on college campuses.
So we've got two more calls, and I'm going to mesh them together. And one says, trigger warnings are the most absurd thing I have ever heard. We're not given that opportunity in life, and college is there to teach us a lesson. And another says, I don't think they're that dangerous or threaten free speech. They exist in other places and are helpful. How do you go about dealing with students that might have gone through some trauma in their lives?
Right. So I think obviously students who've actually gone through some trauma are in a difficult position, and I think you want medical professionals evaluating them and helping guide them and help guide professors about how they ought to deal with them. Most of the debates surrounding trigger warnings, though, don't actually involve identifiable individuals with identifiable medical problems. Instead, they're much more sweeping, much more general concerns. Well, maybe there'll be somebody who might be traumatized by these particular issues. And as a faculty member, you certainly want to be able to give students a heads up on what it is they're going to be reading and encountering in their classes. You don't want students to be taken by surprise. But on the other hand, you also don't want campus administrators intervening and telling you what kinds of warnings you ought to put on your material, which kinds of material you shouldn't be discussing because maybe some students will find it too difficult.
Keith Whittington is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Politics in the Department of Politics at Princeton University. He just wrote a book, Speak Freely, Why Universities Must Defend Free Speech.